Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The news from the U.S. Air Force Academy has been truly shocking. First a few, then more, then 54 cases of rape and sexual abuse of female cadets tumbling out of 10 years of pain and silence, right up to the White House now, with war looming and 15% of active duty troops women. The brass are promising action, a cleanup, change. But what permits a culture of rape in the first place? Not only in this elite corner of the military, but wherever sexual abuse flourishes. We're looking tonight at the Air Force Academy story. We'll hear from a former cadet who faced the culture and was raped. And we'll look beyond the academy to examine other pockets of rape culture in America and why they persist. You can join the conversation. Have you been the victim of a culture that invites, even defends, rape in the military or beyond? And what is the antidote to rape culture? Earlier, I talked with John Ferrugia, a reporter for Denver's ABC affiliate, KMGH-TV. Mr. Ferrugia is part of the investigative team that broke the story of multiple rapes at the U.S. Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs. I asked him to describe the latest developments in the emerging scandal.
Well, as of today, there is an Air Force investigative team that has returned to the Air Force Academy. This consists of 17 investigators. They were here 10 days, a couple of weeks ago. And after they left, we found and reported that indeed they hadn't spoken to any victims or, in fact, had not spoken to officials at an off-base counseling center where many women who had been raped or sexually assaulted had gone. So we have no idea what they were doing other than looking at the program and talking with Air Force officials. It was very embarrassing once we reported this, and now they're back as of yesterday, as of Monday, and they are, in fact, talking to victims now and are, in fact, talking to a counseling center off base. At that counseling center, they've now found that more than 30 women over a 15-year period had come to that counseling center after being raped or sexually assaulted.
I know that your reporting was influential in this story first coming out. How did this begin to tumble out? How has it become nationally, globally known that the U.S. Air Force Academy has this problem?
Initially, we began looking at this based on one or two people who emailed us and said they had been, as they said, disenrolled, kicked out of the Air Force Academy after having reported they were sexually assaulted. We didn't know if this were true, but once we found out in these two cases that it seemed to be true, we then looked at a much broader area, and that was, is there a pattern where women are coming forward, reporting rapes or sexual assaults, and then are drummed out? And what we found was indeed that was true. It's very difficult, as you might expect, to do this or to widen this story, because of the embarrassment, because people felt very isolated. And as you know, with rape victims, you're talking about people who are really hurt. These are people psychologically hurting. They're physically hurting in some ways. And so it was very painful for them. But the way we pursued it was to go from one person to another person to another person and saying, well, do you know another person who might have been assaulted? Well, we came to find out that these women were very isolated. And what they knew was, as one woman told us, one of my friends was there, you know, Tuesday, and on Thursday she was gone. I knew something must have happened. And that's exactly what we began finding. And so we began calling people that they knew, one to the other. And pretty soon we had a widening net of a dozen women to whom this had occurred.
John, was it just as silent as that? Would women just essentially disappear from the academy and people were never quite sure why they had gone when the background was sexual assault or rape?
Tom, the tragedy of this is that women in this climate are so indoctrinated that the academy has such a high standard and they are judged so severely as freshmen. They have absolutely no power. They do not have a voice. Once the academy says to them, once their colleagues say to them, fellow cadets, that you have betrayed us, you have turned one of your own in, you have caused pain and suffering to your unit of 30 people. You are a traitor, and therefore they're totally ostracized. The victims became the persecuted. The victims immediately thought, I've done something wrong. They were put in a position where they had actually done something to betray their cadets. So when they left in shame. They felt they had been the person who was at fault. They were made to feel that way. That's the tragedy of this. These are women who are the smartest, brightest women you will ever meet. These are people that have gone, could go to Harvard or Yale or Stanford, had the grades to do that, but they had that additional element, which was patriotism. They wanted to serve their country. And the real tragedy of this is that you've got, as a taxpayer, you're a taxpayer, I'm a taxpayer, we have been robbed of their talent. I mean, these are very talented people.
What was the Air Force Academy's first response when these reports began to come out in the press and public? And I guess how has that response or posture evolved as the harsh light of real broad scrutiny has come onto the whole situation?
Well, initially, we tried to talk with the superintendent of the Air Force Academy, General John Dallagher. We asked for 3 weeks before we ran our first story for an interview. We didn't hide the ball on these people. We told them what we had. We told them exactly what we wanted to talk with them about. And essentially, they ignored us. They finally gave us a response from the sexual assault director of the academy, who was a major. And once we interviewed her, we knew very clearly that she had no information about the numbers, how broad the problem was. And in fact, what we found was is they had really very little interest in finding out how broad this problem was, what the scope of it was. They didn't even tell General Dallagher that we wanted to do an interview with him. They thought we were a local station and, you know, just forget it, this will go away. Mm-hmm. Because that's always what had happened before. Mm-hmm. Once we began running our stories, and once the Air Force realized what we had, and that this was not just an isolated case, but a pattern of behavior and a systemic pattern of behavior, and a climate, which we were talking about, which accepted sexual assault and rape as a matter of course, as a matter of the process of getting through the academy, that's when it finally took notice. And that's when General Dallagher called me on my cell phone and said, what do you want to talk about?
And at this point, you've got the Pentagon, Congress, the national press, everyone's paying attention. Is there a sense now that the Air Force at the highest levels is fully focused on this and determined to do something?
Well, I think yesterday at the White House, when Ari Fleischer talked about the president's concern, that was a clear public message to the Air Force that it better get things together, and it better get things together very, very quickly. I'm not sure right now whether at the top levels of the Air Force, I certainly know that the Secretary of the Air Force, who has sat down with me and with us several times now, he gets it. It's very clear that he knows the system has to change, and he is adamant about changing the system to make it possible for women to come forward to report sexual assault without fear of retribution.
But this is the civilian secretary. Does that go right down into the heart of the Air Force?
I think that's the question. I think you've hit exactly the question. I don't know that. I don't know that the command structure of the Air Force gets it yet.
How would you describe, in just a few words, John, the core of the problem here? What has gone wrong?
The core of the problem is the Air Force Academy, as an institution, is accepting of sexual assault of women and rape of women within the academy. And it is a systemic issue. And let me tell you how this works. And I think the mechanics of this are rather important. If a young woman reports that she was raped, let's say on a Saturday evening, mm-hmm. there is a rule which says we may, doesn't say we will, it says we may give you amnesty for anything else you might have been doing to break cadet rules that night. For instance, if the young woman was drinking or she were fraternizing, as it's called, by being with upperclassmen, et cetera, well, we'll give you amnesty because we want you to come forward and we won't give you any demerits for those cadet rules being broken. But they then begin investigating the victim, and they talk to her roommate, and they talk to all of the witnesses who were there that night. Incidentally, none of those people get amnesty. So if she comes forward and says, I was raped and there are two witnesses, the two witnesses who may be classmates of hers
are in trouble,
are in big trouble. Okay, they get no amnesty. So that's the first hurdle she has to overcome, being a traitor to those people who are in her squadron. Mm-hmm. Then the OSI, which is the Office of Special Investigations, which is essentially the FBI of the Air Force, they begin investigating the victim. And they go to those witnesses, and they go to her roommate, and they go to anybody else and say, well, have you ever seen her drinking on campus before? Well, yes, 2 weeks ago on Thursday, she did this. Well, has she ever fraternized? Oh, yeah, last week she and two other women were at a movie off base with upperclassmen. So they began compiling a list of hits, as they call them, demerits. And what they do is then they bring the victim in, and they say, well, now we're going to give you amnesty for this particular thing that happened on Saturday, but is it true that you did this on Thursday and you did this last week? If she says no, she's violated the honor code. I will not lie, cheat, or steal. She's gone. If she says yes, she is then given demerits, which end up being what are called tours, hours of physical punishment. So she's in a box. And those tours or those hits which she could get could also be grounds for expulsion.
And what about the alleged rapist in this process?
We have never found one case, not one case, where a cadet has been court-martialed for sexually assaulting another cadet, ever.
Is the Air Force red-faced about that at this point?
The Air Force at this point says that each one of those cases is an individual case, and therefore it cannot talk about individual cases. The bottom line is that women in the Air Force Academy know if I am raped or I am sexually assaulted, then I will either be punished or I will be drummed out. So therefore, if I want a career in the Air Force, I would say nothing.
John Ferrugia, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
John Ferrugia is a reporter for Denver's ABC affiliate KMGH-TV. We are talking tonight about rape culture at the U.S. Air Force Academy and maybe closer to home. Listeners, have you experienced an environment that invites or even defends sexual abuse in the military or elsewhere? What's your antidote to rape culture? And does it surprise you that rape cultures still persist in America 3 decades after the women's liberation movement? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined now by Christine Hansen from Fairfield, Connecticut. She's executive director of the Miles Foundation, a nonprofit organization that studies gender violence in the military. Good evening and welcome, Christine Hansen.
Good evening, Tom.
Thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
I'm also joined from Tucson, Arizona, by Mary Koss, professor of public health at the Arizona College of Public Health. She specializes in sexual violence. She's director of Restore, which offers services to victims of sexual assault and first-time offenders. Mary Koss, thank you for joining us tonight.
Tom, thank you for having me.
Mary, there's a lot to talk about here, but I guess at the very top level, if you could just dive in, how surprised were you by the news from the Air Force Academy? And is this something that in the year 2003 is confined to very tiny, unique corners of our society? Or are there other environments that might be fairly described as rape cultures still active in this country?
Well, the news didn't surprise me at all, because I have been doing research on rape among young people, well, going back to the early 80s. Most of the studies that I have done over the years involve college students. So I wasn't at all surprised when this news came out.
That is college students in college settings, not Air Force academies.
Well, Air Force academies are educational institutions.
Yes.
And they do involve young people in the 18 to 25-year-old age range, which is a peak age range for the occurrence of rape.
But you're saying it's not just in the military setting that you found this?
No. I don't know if it wouldn't surprise me if we found out that the problem was slightly worse in the military academies, because this kind of behavior does tend to be more common in workplaces that were formerly all male,
mm-hmm.
or in professions where success involves stereotypical male qualities, such as aggression and strength.
Mm-hmm. Christine Hansen, you stare at the military in particular on this. Does the U.S. military have a general problem with sexual assault, or is this an odd development at one academy, elite as it may be?
I think that the military does have a serious issue and problem when it comes to interpersonal violence, whether it be sexual assault or domestic violence, which may be related to elements within the military culture as well as the command climate in different units, academies. We've seen historically that Congress has mandated in the early 1990s studies of sexual assault and sexual harassment through the General Accounting Office, at the various academies, and we've also conducted a number of studies throughout the military departments concerning sexual violence since Tailhook in 1991.
Tailhook raised a big flag. There's a lot to talk about tonight. We're going to go through this in detail. We're joined by Christine Hansen and Mary Koss. We'll be right back with them. We're talking about rape culture at the U.S. military, at the U.S. Air Force Academy, and maybe closer to home as well. Is the Air Force Academy an outlier here, or is this a problem across the U.S. military? What breeds a rape culture in the military or anywhere else? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about rape culture at the U.S. Air Force Academy and maybe closer to home. My guests have been Christine Hansen, Executive Director of the Miles Foundation, a nonprofit organization that studies gender violence in the military, and Mary Koss, Professor of Public Health at the Arizona College of Public Health, specializing in sexual violence. You can join the conversation as well. Have you ever been a victim of or part of an environment that invites, even defends, sexual abuse? Can we have a gung-ho, co-ed military without sexual assault? Or another way of looking at it, can we maintain an effective co-ed military if it's not reined in? And what is the antidote to rape culture? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined now from Solana Beach, California, by Tammy Jones. Good evening and welcome, Tammy Jones.
Good evening, Tom.
Thank you for joining us. Tammy, I guess in brief, you attended the U.S. Air Force Academy.
That's right.
You were raped there as a freshman cadet in 1982. You kept that quiet for many, many years. You're talking about it now. What happened and why are you now public with your history?
Well, first of all, I came forward because I was so amazed at the courage and strength that these 18, 19, 20-year-old women that are currently in the middle of this situation had to come forward. It's a very scary thing to come forward and speak about these things. And when I saw them do that, you know, first of all, I was outraged to know that this was still going on, that nothing had changed 21 years after this had happened to me. And when I saw that they had the courage to come forward, I came forward mainly to provide support for them.
So really also, in solidarity in a way.
That's right. That's right.
Tammy Jones, why is it so incredibly difficult? I mean, it's difficult for any person, and especially a young person. We all understand that. But every voice we hear tonight is telling us that it is just unbelievably difficult in the Air Force Academy environment to come forward. What makes it such a challenge?
Well, I think there's a lot of shame involved, and the culture does not set up to allow women to come forward. I actually, Tom, did come forward and reported this to through my chain of command, which has been the recent suggestion for the changes they want to make at the academy. They're saying that women should be able to report to their chain of command. Well, I tried to do that, and I was completely shut down by my commander and told not to speak of it again.
Tammy, we should make clear for our listeners who may not understand, and I have to admit I didn't either, that the chain of command, as I understand it, may include simply an upperclassman, a young man just a year or two older, who's the first step in that chain. Is that right?
That's right. And in fact, the person that raped me was actually in my chain of command, and it sets up a system where 19 and 20-year-old kids really have complete and total authority over 18 and 19-year-old kids, and it's I think that's a real core issue that the Air Force is going to have to look at and make some changes.
Tammy, when this happened to you, did you have the sense at the time that this was an outrageous exception to the norm, to the culture that you were part of at the academy, that brought special shame to it, or did it feel like this is par for the course, suck it up, deal with it?
I think it was suck it up, deal with it. I was really shocked when it happened, but by the time I had talked to a couple of other women about it, I started to realize that without them saying that it had happened to them, I started to realize that they were not shocked. They were not surprised that this had happened to me. And you know, being in one of the first classes of women, I thought, well, maybe this is just something we all have to go through. We go through a lot of hard things as women at the Academy, and I thought, maybe this is just one more thing, but it's a pretty outrageous thing to feel that way.
And looking back now, from all after all these years and your years of maturity, what's your view today?
My view of the whole situation is that I think they're going to have to change the entire culture and climate at the Academy. I think that, you know, beginning with walking in the door at basic training, sexual harassment is accepted. Women are not treated as equals. We're kind of singled out, and I've never felt like they've totally integrated women into the Academy. And I think that sets up a situation where the sexual harassment can lead to crossing other boundaries and can eventually even lead to rape situations. And it's just not a healthy climate overall, Tom.
Tammy Jones, let me ask you a final question. But you're the one who was in the military. You stayed at the Academy. You went into the military.
Right.
You know, in the popular imagination, we understand the military as this gung-ho, high testosterone, fierce kind of environment, macho in many respects, and maybe at no point more than the kind of, you know, the fly boys, now fly girls as well, I guess, of the Air Force Academy. As a one-time military person, do you believe that we can have a military that is adequately fired up and fierce and at the same time fully reined in on the front, or at least reasonably reined in, whatever that means, on the front of sexual assault? Is there something, you know, innate to a fierce macho military that brings sexual abuse along with it? And can we have an effective military without that culture?
I really think we can, Tom. I don't think that macho attitude needs to be present in order to have a successful fighting force and in order to defend our country. I would like to see more pride in and patriotism and those being the core values rather than macho, that macho attitude. I feel like women have played an extremely vital role in the military, since the beginning.
And they certainly do as we speak tonight, thousands in the Gulf now.
That's right. And, you know, I don't think there's any place for that macho attitude. I think that, people can be effective fighter pilots and effective engineers and, you know, all the other vital jobs in the Air Force without there being any place for that macho attitude.
Tammy Jones, we salute you for coming forward in solidarity with these young cadets, and thank you for talking with us tonight.
Thank you very much for having me, Tom.
Good night.
Good night.
Tammy Jones joined us from Solana Beach, California. She was raped as a freshman cadet at the U.S. Air Force Academy in 1982. Christine Hansen, you follow these issues closely. Is this a typical, if there is such a thing as a typical story that we hear from Tammy Jones, the chain of command in her case included the young man who raped her?
I think, Tom, that yes, it is quite typical, particularly at the academies where you have senior cadets overseeing those who are freshmen and sophomores, et cetera. I think what Tammy has described, you know, involves what best could be termed abuse of power, which she noted there was sexual harassment, which led to the crossing of boundaries and into sexual assault. So I think that it's very important. One other comment, Tom, is that it's rather hideous that, you know, as a rite of passage for a woman to engage in a non-traditional career choice or opportunity, that she would feel it incumbent not necessarily that she, but it would be incumbent upon her that she would be violated in such a way in order to pursue her dreams, and that in particular of flying in the United States Air Force.
It's a very sad idea. Mary Koss, you were describing these elements that you find as common threads in cultures particularly open to rape, and you said, I was very interested, you said, one, in careers or fields traditionally that have historically been dominated by men, and secondly, that are associated with masculine qualities, there's perhaps nothing more than the military that would fall into that those define. Is this solvable?
I think that you have the conflict here where you have males in the military may have very traditional gender role attitudes. And you have women who are seeking careers in non-traditional areas and arenas. Mm-hmm. And those may conflict dramatically.
Mary Koss, let me put that same question to you, if I may.
I think one thing to point out is that this episode that's going on, to me, breaks down into two components. One is the component of what is causing it and what can we learn from that to build into prevention programs. And the second component is how is the Air Force and how are the military, is the military in general responding to and addressing violations that occur in ways that communicate accountability mm-hmm. to not only individuals but to the in a general sense. And I wanted to share with you a story of something that I was involved in when Pat Schroeder was the representative from Colorado.
Later a presidential candidate.
Yes. Mm-hmm. It came to my attention that there was a program in the Air Force where a private consultant was going around teaching the investigatory branch how to detect false rape complaints. Mm-hmm. And we inspected the training materials and saw that it consisted of a list of characteristics that Air Force inspectors were being taught to alert them that they were dealing with someone who was falsely reporting rape. Now, one of the very first items on the list was a woman who had been previously victimized.
Mm-hmm. So if it's happened more than once, she's probably not telling the truth, is the suggestion?
As far as we could tell, this material was based on no science whatsoever because one of the best established findings in the field of sexual assault is that earlier victimization does somewhat raise the risk of future victimization. So we had to enlist the help of Representative Schroeder to stop this training. Mm-hmm. But, of course, we have no idea how many bases were trained in this process before it was stopped.
So the fundamental approach to the problem may not be right on the beam. Christine Hansen, Mary Koss, please stand by. A lot of callers want to join us. I want to invite some in. Manuga's calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Good evening. You're on the air.
Good evening, Tom.
Hi.
In 1995, funded by the USAID, I was selected as the consulting psychologist for the War Victims Project under Armed Corps and Save the Children to recover women who were raped, tortured, and mutilated in the war of ethnic cleansing.
And in which war in particular, Money?
The war in Abkhazia, in the Republic of Georgia, the Black Sea.
All right.
A lot wasn't heard about because we were kind of inundated with the O.J. Simpson trial.
Important things.
And it was a humbling experience. I was the only male involved. I, was out finding women therapists and so on to go and do this job and write a manual.
And what did you learn from that, Manug, that can help us in our thinking tonight about this issue of rape culture and
well,
maybe military?
There is a continuum when you look at all the militaries and all the wars that were going on in Europe and Bosnia and so on, where there was an organized effort, a permissive effort, and where individual soldiers did these actions. And not to blur the lines, but somewhere in the continuum you would see something like this. I remember after this, I approached Commandant Kruak at an event. And
who is he, Manu?
This the police.
Who is he?
He was the Commandant of the Marine Corps
okay.
at the time of the Okinawa rapes.
All right.
And,
this is of Japanese citizens.
Offered him my phone number and so on, and tried to get the military to be a little bit proactive on this. in the end, my job was just, the hard part is to find, as it has been for this journalist, is to find the victims. The second part is to rehabilitate them, in our case, not only psychologically, but physically. And the third thing is to re-empower these women. That's another point. But I'm as well looking for the answers. I just looked at the permissiveness of the culture, and I look at the fact that there has been some writing where men who do this believe that there are other men, say like an invisible audience of men cheering them on. And there's an axiom that says, for this sort of evil to continue, it only takes good people to be to remain silent. And I think that one of the ways we can look at this, especially in these environments, is to break that silence, that no man should ever think that this is permitted by other men. But our silence as men in these communities is, I think, feeds this.
Manoog, we've got it, and thank you. Thank you for your call. Mary Koss, what about that? Is there an understanding in this academy environment, in other environments, where there's a tacit endorsement by men of other men engaging in this?
You know, people learn not to punch their boss in the face because there's consequences for doing that. And one of the major problems we have with sexual assault in the United States in general is that we don't do that much about it when it involves people who know each other. So to a large extent, there hasn't been any. Yes, the law is on the books. Yes, we have prevention, education. But when it comes right down to it, men have never heard of anyone who got in trouble for doing this.
You're talking about men in the Air Force Academy, men in general?
I'm talking about young men in general, and in that I'm including young men in the Air Force Academy.
They won't personally know some. And what about in the military environment, Christine Hansen, when the element of violence and, in fact, instruction in violence and, at some degree, necessarily encouragement of the violent side of a young male, is there a link between encouraging that and a propensity to sexual violence?
It has been very difficult, and I think Mary will agree, for us to actually calculate that and get some definitive data as to any links, connections, et cetera, between military training and whether or not it leads to violence. I think that two important points that need to be made are that you're talking about male peer support, which could lead to, the support of emotional violence and physical violence, which could then lead to sexual aggression. And also, just another point, the rape checklist that Mary has outlined previously may actually continue to exist within the Air Force. The amnesty program described by the journalist from Colorado specifically has certain elements within it that continue to perpetuate this rape checklist.
It feels like it might. We'll be right back and talk more about a rape culture at the U.S. Air Force Academy and maybe closer to home, maybe elsewhere as well. You can join us. What breeds a rape culture in the military or anywhere else? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about rape culture at the U.S. Air Force Academy and maybe closer to home. You can join the conversation. Is the Air Force Academy an outlier here, or is this a problem across the U.S. military? And can you understand why so many women went so long at the Air Force Academy without stepping forward with their stories of rape or sexual assault? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. We're joined tonight by Christine Hansen. She's executive director of the Miles Foundation, a nonprofit organization that studies gender violence in the military, and from Tucson, Arizona, by Mary Koss, professor of public health at the Arizona College of Public Health, specializing in sexual violence. Andrew's on the line. Welcome, Andrew. You're on the air.
I just wanted to bring my experience with my training as a soldier in the United States Army.
Please.
I entered the Army basic training in 1986, and when we were being in-processed, where you're basically standing around filling out forms for 3 days, one thing that struck me was that in one of the processing centers that I was in, there was a poster on the wall, rather disheveled soldier, looked like he was crying, and the caption on the poster read, I was drunk. She led me on. She was drunk. And then the in much bolder letters below that, no means no, soldier. You know, no excuses. And this was, you talk about a pervasive culture, but this was training for infantry privates. This is this is the lowest echelon.
So they're starting at the ground up and saying no means no, soldier.
Yes, but this was 1986. This was Fort Benning, Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
This is the United States Army in the middle of the Reagan buildup. I don't know if that makes any difference. I'd also like to pose the question: How does this rate of assault at the Air Force Academy stack up against other higher learning institutions such as Harvard, Yale? I mean,
that's a great question.
The number there quoted at the beginning of the show was 54 women in 10 years. That's reprehensible. 8 at 1 is reprehensible.
Mm-hmm.
But that averages out 5 per year. And how do other institutions stack up to that?
That's a terrific question, Andrew. And let us take it up, and thank you for your call. Christine Hansen, do you have numbers on that, or Mary Koss?
I think I can give you some numbers.
Mary. Mm-hmm.
You know, you have to make the distinction between rapes that get reported and rapes that occur but are not reported.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Generally, on a campus of 36,000 students, you'll get about 3 or 4 rapes that get reported to the police a year.
Of 36,000 students.
The reporting of rapes among college students is quite low. For some of the same reasons that have already been mentioned, they were often doing other things that they're afraid they'll be in trouble for. However, if you use surveys to try to figure out how many rapes happened, whether they were reported or not reported, the most recent survey we have was completed in the year 2000, and those findings show that between 1 in 4 and 1 in 5 college women are raped at some point during their college career.
So rate of reporting low, rate of rape amazingly high.
Yes.
Okay. Christine Hansen, what's your perspective?
It has been consistently estimated across 2 national studies that 5% or less of college student rape victims report to the police.
Christine Hansen, what is your sense of the prevalence, the rape at the Air Force Academy? Are we unfairly singling it out here by holding it up to the light, or is there a particular problem?
I think Mary's correct in that it's very hard to ascertain between reported cases and survey results what the actual numbers may be of sexual assault at the Air Force Academy or at West Point or the Naval Academy or the Coast Guard Academy.
Because, of course, we're not saying this 54 is all the rapes that necessarily took place. It's,
exactly.
It's simply what's been reported at this point.
Mm-hmm.
But what about Andrew's fundamental question? He wants to honestly know, does this institution of higher learning affiliated with the Air Force have a more serious problem than colleges across the country?
Well, I think historically, and Mary also made this point, that sexual violence, particularly rape and sexual assault, are underreported just by virtue of the fact of the victim's, you know, fear of retaliation, the fear of public exposure.
But what about the relative prevalence, if you can speak directly to that? Because it is the kind of the underlying assumption in this conversation. Does the Air Force Academy, to your mind, you study this all the time, have a worse problem than universities in general in America today?
You know, I think it's possible that the various academies have this information.
Yes.
But they are not releasing it to the public. Because I have been consulted by several of them, but never permitted to actually be present on campus and supervise the collection.
But here's a number, 54 in 10 years. We can look at that number. And, of course, we're not saying it's complete, but no numbers are complete. So what inference should we draw?
Well, the issue here, as Mary alluded to, is that the United States military academies are not required under the Jean Cleary Act, formerly known as the Campus Security Act, under the Department of Education, to provide data concerning reported cases. Their data is reported to the Department of Defense or the Department of the Air Force specifically. Mm. And routinely, we have seen everything from slippages to underreporting to issues with consistent reporting of data that's collected within the military departments and then transmitted on to the Pentagon.
Andrew, it sounds like we're not going to get a real clear bead on that tonight, but I'm looking at something here from the Denver Post that did catch my eye. This is the story of another cadet who reported a rape at the Air Force Academy, Elisa Ballas, who went before General Taco Gilbert, Commandant of Cadets, a general at the Air Force Academy, went to talk with him about court-martialing her alleged attacker, a senior cadet who she said raped her at a party. Within a couple of minutes, she told the Denver Post, the general said to her, "Any other man would have done the same that night. You need to take responsibility for your actions." Now, to be fair, the alleged attacker's lawyer says they were playing strip poker. A lot of clothes were already off. But the general told her when she came with the complaint that her behavior implied consent, to which she responded, "You know, he didn't have to rape me." But it doesn't sound like it was a very a receptive commandant of cadets meeting her there, Christine Hansen.
No, it does not at all, Tom. I think, you know, her case and many of the other cases that we've become aware of at the Academy indicate that there's quite a bit of victim blaming, if you will, and placing the responsibility for these violent assaults upon the victim and neglecting to address the responsibility of an alleged assailant to hold that assailant accountable, as well as to have system accountability for their response.
Here's something that surprised me then. The Air Force panel that went out to look at this has already been to come out with recommendations, and one of them is to reduce the proximity of male and female living quarters. We've only got a minute left here, but they said that this proximity, where men and women see each other walking down the hall in bathrobes, quote, erodes the dignity of male and female interaction. That's the part that has to be restored. Mary Koss, in the same story, this is in the Washington Post, experts in sexual harassment are saying that's the wrong approach. It mm-hmm. sounds right to pull men and women apart.
No, it's absolutely the wrong approach.
Yes.
Why? As a layman, it sounds like that might be where you might start.
I think, Tom, if I could interject,
yes, Christine.
I think it's a short-term solution. It's a very simplistic solution. Mm-hmm. And we've seen research, both Mary and I have seen research and participated in research that actually indicates that the integration of men and women in units, et cetera, lessens the prevalence of sexual violence, domestic
Why?
Violence, et cetera, within the military culture.
Why? Why would that be the result?
I think one of the things that results from that is that women are respected and honored for their capabilities and generally accepted within these non-traditional roles. You also are able to engage support of the command and to continue to pursue your careers.
Because everybody's right there. Christine Hansen, Mary Koss, we're out of time, but it's been great having you. I want to thank you so much for joining us. Thanks to both of you for coming on tonight.
Thank you, Tom.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks for the show, Christine. Thanks for your work. Tammy, I salute you.
Yeah, as
thank
do we
you,
all.
Tammy.
Christine Hansen is executive director of the Miles Foundation, a nonprofit that studies gender violence in the military, and Mary Koss is professor of public health at the Arizona College of Public Health, specializing in sexual violence. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. In a moment, a small Rhode Island town votes on its own Iraq War resolution. This is On Point. More than 125 cities and counties across the United States have passed resolutions opposing preemptive military action in Iraq. Among those that have signed on against war, Baltimore, Atlanta, and Chicago. New York is expected to pass a similar resolution in the coming days. Last night, the council of a much smaller town considered its own anti-war resolution, Jamestown, Rhode Island. A public debate over the resolution raged on for an hour and a half at last night's town council meeting, pitting neighbor against neighbor in this small island town. Mark Baker runs a cruise ship company in Jamestown. He worked to get the resolution on the council's agenda, but after watching last night's debate, he worries that the same disagreements that have divided the UN Security Council are now dividing the town he calls home.
Jamestown is a town of 5,000 people on an island in the Narragansett Bay. Though there are two bridges to the mainland, the couple of miles of salt water that separates us from the rest of Rhode Island has kept our town a vital and tight-knit community. We have a single one-half-mile-long commercial street with all the services that anyone would need. Many residents don't leave the island for months at a time. Most of the islanders participate in our civic activities like Memorial Day ceremony and the opening day of Little League, where boys and girls in their new uniforms parade down our main street to the bowl field. But that's not to say there aren't disagreements. There are political issues in the community that can sometimes be bitterly fought over. When neighbors argue in town council, personal grudges are sometimes created that can last for decades. But our issues are usually small, like the annual fees for boat moorings or the location of the new highway barn. But the debate at last night's town council meeting tore at the fabric of my small town. On the agenda, right after a comment on the new noise ordinance, was open discussion on a resolution opposing the war on Iraq. I had helped bring the resolution to the council agenda so that we as a town could consider and weigh in on the war. The resolution has been the talk of our coffee shops for weeks, and last night was the most heavily attended council meeting in years. All of the seats in the library were filled, and the walls were lined with people. I saw many familiar faces, one of the town doctors, the baker, and that fellow that always walks his giant dogs in our street. And I had no idea on which side of the debate they would come down. As the discussion started to heat up, I couldn't help feeling that we had let a genie out of the bottle and that it could be a very long time before we get it back in. The war was exposing fault lines in our personal experience that could well change our community. Korean War veterans argued that opposing the war was like turning our back on American soldiers, which is a big deal in a part of the country with long-standing ties to the Navy. Several speakers countered that it was not the American way to make a preemptive attack on another country. The debate raged on and on for an hour and a half. Some of the speakers were soft-spoken and a bit timid, and others shook with anger. The entire room fell quiet when a flushed elderly man with a very kindly face began to speak. In his heavy accent, he told us that he was born in France and was 13 years old when the Nazis occupied his village of Brest in Brittany. He said that in the 4 years of occupation, over 80% of his village was destroyed. "You have to know," he said, "what it is like to hear the bombs falling, to see the devastation, and feel the shock of the bombardment." He said that he felt deeply not only for our soldiers, but also for the Iraqis that will be in this war, and that we should remember that we are talking about people dying. A few of the speakers said that they wanted our town to stay quiet and that this resolution could ruin it for us. But we all knew that when we left the library last night, that we would take with us the great questions of war, peace, and death that were spoken in the chamber, and that at least for now, there were two new categories of islanders, those for and those against the war. Early this morning, I said hello, as I do most mornings, to the fellow with the big dogs. But after last night, clearly there are things that we will not be talking about. And I expect that this is how it is going to be from here on out. Unspoken distances, conversations not begun, and invitations not made. Depending on events, our citizens may once again debate this war, but at the very least, all of us know how the conflict of war can rage far away from the battlefield. I don't know how long it will be before our little island can return to the light-hearted harmony we have always felt, but I expect that some of my fellow members on the Christmas Tree Committee will now look at me differently, and I at them, and that in some way our relationship will be decided in the streets of Baghdad.
Mark Baker, the Jamestown Town Council, declined to vote on the resolution at its meeting last night. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.